Ahimsaka was the son of the royal chaplain of the court of King Pasenadi, which all of you knew, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, yeah, okay. We'll do our Buddhology trivia tonight. Astrologers noted that Ahimsaka was born under the, they call it the dog constellation. I think it's actually Sirius, the dog star. And they thought that meant that he was had some vulnerability for being a criminal. So his parents gave him the name Ahimsaka, which means no harm, in hopes that would inspire this ideal. And they raised him with a lot of care and a lot of kindness. And indeed, he did grow up to be strong and intelligent and very well behaved and quite diligent in his studies. So much so that they sent him off to the Indian University at Takaskila. And there was, which you all know about, right? there was a very renowned teacher who accepted him as a student. And he excelled in his studies, and he was so humble and so devoted to serving his teacher that he became the teacher's favorite. And the family would give him meals. Some of the other students were envious of this. And so they started scheming if they could figure out some way to drive a wedge between him and his teacher. And so they started this whispering campaign over a series of many months where they would just drop a hint to the teacher that, Ahimsaka really is very disloyal. He's actually trying to figure out ways to get you pushed out. Well, at first his teacher just dismissed all the innuendos, but after a while his poisonous seeds began to take root in the teacher's heart, and so he started to figure out how to get rid of Ahimsaka, how to get him out of there. By this time, Ahimsaka was almost done with his studies, and so the teacher said to him, "To finish your studies, there's one more thing you have to do. You have to give me a gift." And Ahimsaka said, "Oh, yes, master, I'll be glad to do that. What should I give you?" And his teacher said, "You must give me 1,000 fingers from the right hand." I think the teacher figured if he really did this, he'd probably get caught or killed in the process. And Ahimsaka said, "Oh, master, how could I do that? I can't, my family never does any violence." But the teacher was very firm about this. He said, "If you don't pay proper homage to your studies, all the things you've learned will bear no fruit." So eventually Ahimsaka was persuaded of what he had to do. So he gathered some shields and and swords and all kinds of things and retreated into the wild Jalini forest up near in his home province of Kosala. And he took up residence in this high cliff that overlooked a road down below. And so he would sit up there along this cliff, and when he saw a traveler, he would hurry down there and kill him and cut off a finger. And then he took the fingers and hung them in a tree where the birds would eat the flesh away from it. And then when they were picked clean to keep them from rotting, he strung them in a garland and a necklace that he wore around his neck. So, the news of these gory crimes began to spread, but nobody knew the identity of who was doing this. So they took to calling him Angulimala, which literally means finger garland. People stopped traveling through the Jalini forest, as you can imagine. So we had to venture a little further out into the forest to the few villages that were around there to find more victims. And then, like refugees from a war zone, the people in villages began to abandon their homes and go into the cities for protection. And so it was through all this that King Pasenadi learned of this one-man reign of terror out there. And so he gathered up a regiment of soldiers and went out to hunt the guy down. The Buddha also heard about this in the same way. But with his great intuitive sense, he picked up that there was actually some goodness deep down in there in Angulima. So the Buddha went up to pay him a visit. So we'll pick the story up here. This is from the Angulimala Sutta, the discourse on Angulimala, which is in the Middle Discourses, Majjhima Nikaya, number 86. By this time, Angulimala had killed 999 people. He had one more to go. Angulimala saw the Blessed One coming from afar and thought, "It's amazing. It's astounding. Groups of 10, 20, 30, and 40 men have gone along this road and fallen into my hands. Yet now this contemplative comes attacking, as it were, alone and without a companion. I think I'll kill him." So Angulimala took his sword and shield and buckled on his bow and quiver and ran with all his might to catch the Buddha, who was walking at a normal pace. Yet he couldn't catch him. Angulimala thought, "Isn't it amazing? Isn't it astounding? I could catch a swift elephant, a swift horse, a swift chariot, a swift deer, and seize them. But I can't catch this recluse walking at a normal pace." So he stopped and called out, "Stop, recluse, stop." The Buddha turned to him and said, "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." Angulimala asked, "What does this mean? How have you stopped? How have I not?" The Buddha said, "Angulimala, once and for all, I have cast off violence towards all living beings. That's how I have stopped. You are unrestrained towards all beings. That's how you have not stopped." Listen to this line carefully, this next one. Angulimala thought, at long last, a revered great seer has come to the forest for my sake. There's a lot in these stories that have been edited out of the transmission, but you just hear that. At long last, a revered great seer has come into the forest for my sake. I will renounce evil doing forever. He hurled his sword and weapons into a gaping chasm. He paid homage at the Sublime One's feet, and right then and there requested the going forth so that he could become a monk and a disciple of the Buddha. The Buddha said, "Come, monk." And with those simple words, Angulimala became a monk. Angulimala followed the Buddha back. They walked back to Shabasti and began his training there as a monk, which included a lot of things, meditation and alms rounds. And though he had shaved off his hair and was wearing robes, when he went on alms round, a lot of people would recognize him and they were frightened. And they wouldn't give him food. Some of them would throw clods and sticks, all kinds of things at him. So he would come back to the monastery, sometimes cut and bleeding. But he continued to do his alms round because that's what was expected of a monk. And then one day when he was on alms rounds, he saw a woman who was in labor and was having great difficulty. It looked like there was a good possibility she might die. And he was very touched by all this, very moved by her suffering. And when he got back to the monastery, he said something about this to the Buddha, voiced his concern. And the Buddha said, "Well, you should go help her." So he sent word that he was coming, and in the family, they hung a curtain up, a blanket across the room, and a chair on one side, so he could sit in the room without seeing the woman. And so he came and he sat there. And his presence was actually very serene. And in his presence, this woman's difficulties began to subside. And in the text, they say, and the infant and the mother were healed. And she had the smooth delivery. Well, it seemed like a miracle, and the word spread about this, so other women sought him out for help. And as more and more healed, people's attitudes towards him changed. He began to receive food on his alms rounds. But a few people still threw things at him. But he bore all these injuries with a peaceful mind and heart. In time, he became a fully enlightened, fully awakened Arahat. Four stages of awakening, the Arahat is the top, completed. And so eventually, he retired into the forest and lived out the rest of his life serenely. We don't know much about his later years, except there are a few verses around, some in the Sutta and some in the Dhammapada. Things he had spoke, like, who once did live in negligence, and then in negligence is no more. He illuminates the world like a moon freed from a cloud. Who checks the evil deeds he did by doing wholesome deeds instead. He illuminates this world like the moon freed from a cloud. Today in Buddhist countries where Buddhism predominates, like almost all children know the sort of dramatic story of Agulimala. And pregnant women look upon him like we in our country, like we look on a patron saint. Someone whose blessing would ensure a successful delivery and help children come joyfully into the world. Quite a story. So I just want to go back through just a few parts of it. When Angulimala began meditation training with the Buddha, he probably had moments of joy and moments of peacefulness and spaciousness and deep relief. But I strongly suspect it was not all sweetness and light. You know, given the momentum of his crimes, the horrible things he had done, they were still moving through him. And I suspect that the cuts and the bruises that he got from having stones thrown at him were really pretty minor compared to the horror of the images that would arise in his mind. And I can imagine there must have been times when he was like really, really discouraged with his practice. When we sit down to meditate, you and I, sometimes we have moments of joy and peace and ease, or maybe some insights that bring great relief, maybe even little tastes of freedom, you know, little. And then it all falls apart, right? The mind goes out and spins around the room like a party balloon that slipped out of our hands before we tied off the valve. Smashes into the wall and falls to the floor like a total failure. So when we meditate, we may have, you know, sweet, graceful moments, and then there are moments when the mind is as nimble as a drunken dwarf trying to ballet in heavy boots. I remember when I was training in Thailand, one morning I got out my journal and I wrote, my mind has checked out every other book from the Library of Congress and is trying to read all of them at once. My mind, it just seemed like I had this image of like 10,000 buffaloes that were stampeding across the plain. So there are times when this practice can be really quite discouraging. You know, when we think, you know, I just don't have it. It's beyond me. I can get a little taste, but I'm no yogi. I just don't have a talent for it. So it's in this context that I like to share the story of Angulimala for several reasons. One is because within a span of a few years, he went from killing 999 people to being a fully enlightened Arahat. So unless we have killed more than 999 people in the last few years, there is plenty of hope for us. There's plenty of hope for us. There is nothing essential to us that is keeping us from going as far as we can go. The Sutta has a way of saying to us, you know, look how far astray you can go, how messed up things can get, and you can still awaken, fully awaken. Another reason that I like to share this story is that it's, you know, it's kind of reassuring that the amount of distractions we can have without them being fatal. You know, how far the mind can go astray without it being permanent. You know, there are just so many stresses in our lives. You ever notice that? There are, and we have all done bad things, right? All of us, intentionally or unintentionally. We've all stumbled over and over and over. So it's not surprising that these disturbing states will come up inside us, particularly with this practice, because this practice is about seeing the truth of how things are. It's not about shielding us from anything. As any of the Buddha discovered, it's, you know, you can't hide from the truth. You really have to see what's going on. So it's saying that the problem, you know, with the practice is not who we are. It truly isn't. It may be who we think we are. It may be who we fear we are. It may be who we hope we aren't. But it's not about the essence of what we are. We take refuge in our true nature, even if we don't fully understand what that is. We take refuge in the truth of how things are, even if we don't fully understand it. So the third reason, and really the main reason I wanted to share this sutta with you, is because it hints that there may be a relationship between our greatest gifts and our greatest vulnerabilities. Ahimsaka's greatest gift was healing. He was a healer. You know, he had such serenity that people, the women in difficult labor, they just smoothed out. And children who probably otherwise might have died were brought safely into the world. And his greatest vulnerability manifested in killing innocent people, you know, taking lives violently out of the world. It's really, it's a remarkable contrast. So it suggests that our gifts and our greatest gifts and our greatest vulnerabilities may be fraternal twins. Any religion, any spirituality, any philosophy that has any depth to it at all acknowledges that the human heart has an incredible capacity for compassion, for kindness, for courage, for helping other people. And we have a great potential to do damage to ourselves and other people. All of us. So all of us have inside us an Ahimsaka and an Agulima. Or if you prefer, an Anakin Skywalker and a Darth Vader. Angels and demons. We all have a Buddha nature and a Mara nature, if you know Mara's embodiment of delusion. We can help and we can harm. So our greatest gifts and our greatest vulnerabilities are what I would call Dhamma gifts and Dhamma vulnerabilities. And these go way beyond just ordinary talents and frailties. So all of us have ordinary gifts. You may be good at writing or poetry or You're good with children or making things with your hands or computer programming. Those are sort of normal talents. And all of us have ordinary vulnerabilities. Maybe we're short-tempered, impulsive, easily discouraged, conflict-avoidant. So all the stuff of personality and psychology, ordinary gifts and ordinary vulnerabilities. But Dhamma gifts are much deeper than this. Dhamma gifts are ways that we connect with the core of life itself. They're ways that we touch the source of well-being, which is undisturbed by the surface of life. These are ways that we are already enlightened. You know, I took that phrase, already enlightened, as a metaphor until I met Sansan Ing, this Korean Zen master. I went in for my first interview. He said, "There it is." Meaning the moment when I was fully enlightened. And he was right. I could see it. I could feel it. And he said, "Now you've lost it." And he was right. It was gone. But the gift of that was that I think we all have those moments, but they are so far from our self-image that they go by unnoticed. So his gift was he caught me in one and pointed out before I could forget it. So all of us, I think, have one or two Dhamma gifts. And they may be so close to us that we don't recognize them. They may be so ignored. They may have been so ignored in our childhood that they don't seem real. They may have been so denied that we feel cynical about them, but they are there. They are there. For example, some of you have the gift of oneness. You just sense how everything is a part of everything else. And it may be that the only place that this gift manifests is when you're out in the wilderness or out in the field. You get out in nature and something just relaxes inside. It's like the ways that you hold yourself together just soften. And you just melt. And have this sense of just how everything is connected together. And it may be so strong that you don't even articulate it intellectually. You just feel it. You know what I mean? Like Ahimsaka's concern for women in labor, some of you have the gift of compassion. You're just drawn to serve the suffering and the oppressed. And you're not doing it because you're trying to alleviate some guilt. You're not trying to be a good boy or a good girl or a do-gooder. There's something in you that just feels more alive and open when your heart is flowing into service of others. Some of you have Ahimsaka's gift of serenity. You just see the perfection of everything as it is or as it is unfolding. And because you can see that so clearly, you can look deeply right into someone's suffering and not be disturbed by it. You know, so your serenity becomes a little contagious. So it brings you a great deal of peace, but it also brings a great deal of comfort to other people. Just because of that capacity. Some of you have a gift of lawfulness. Some of you have a gift of joy. Some the gift of faith. Some the gift of generosity, generosity of spirit. Some of you have the gift of innocence and openness. Non-defensiveness. So there are probably 10 or 15 distinct Dhamma gifts, but I think they're all related to one another, so all of us can sense them a little bit. But I think all of us have one or two of these in great abundance. They may be different than Ahimsaka's, but all of us, one or two of these that just shine while the other is a little dimmer in the background. So if this was all there was to our story, life would be wonderful. Life would be great. We'd, you know, sweet and peaceful and blissful and clear, you know, like Ahimsaka in later years. Life would be groovy. But life is a little more interesting than that. There is a dark side to each of these gifts. There is a shadow side. All of us have a dark side. Like Ahimsaka, we are gifted, and we also get confused. We have flaws and weaknesses and blind spots. So, for example, just think about this. There are many obstacles in life, right? Washed out bridges, barricades, potholes, fallen trees. Life impinges upon us in many ways. Stubbed toes, thoughtless people, blocked opportunities, disappointments. You and I can run into the same difficulty, and we may have very different responses to it. We can have very different responses. Social rejection. You know, we all get social rejection at times. For some people, it just rolls off their back, you know, like water off a duck. Other people drown. Under pressure. Some people get discouraged. Some people are invigorated. Other people may feel lethargic. Some people start worrying about safety. When we're blocked, one person gets resentful, another feels abandoned, one feels inspired. Some people just have a hard time getting off the dime. And other people just jump the gun over and over and over again. Some people are more prone to anxiety, some more to depression. So if you have ever, you know, been in a difficult situation and you had this thought, you wonder, how did I get here again? You know, I know this pothole so well. How is it that I fell into this one again? That's probably related to some of your deepest vulnerabilities. So if there is only one thing that you take away from this talk tonight, I hope that it is a willingness to entertain the possibility that your greatest gifts and your greatest vulnerabilities may be tied to one another. For example, if you have the gift of oneness, then when you are thrown off balance, when something trips you up, you are probably more prone to feeling isolated, alone, and cut off from all of life. Probably much more so than most people. Because your great sensitivity to a sense of connection, when you feel cut off, it feels like you've lost it completely. It's the same sensitivity when it gets turned around. If you have the gift of a serenity, let's say, then when you're thrown off balance, you're much more likely to feel jumpy or moody, or have your mind race, again, because of that sensitivity. If you have the gift of compassion, when you run into a roadblock, you're much more likely to feel frustrated or angry. So, this is cute. If you think about the word compassion, 70% of it's made up of passion. So when you get blocked, it's much more likely to flare outwardly as anger or inwardly as a kind of a seething or a grumbling. So if you want to know what your Dhamma gifts and Dhamma vulnerabilities are, you can contemplate two sets of questions. First set is you just ask yourself, honestly and openly, what's the beauty in me? What are my Dhamma gifts? How is it that I connect most easily with life? And suspend all your judgments, you know, and just listen to your intuition. And then after a while, you can switch to the second set of questions. What are some of the ways that I hide my beauty? What are some of the ways that I am deeply vulnerable? What are some of my quirks and weaknesses and blind spots? Do you see those? So, another place that our gifts and vulnerabilities manifest is in our meditation. We have lovely moments and then we have unlovely moments. We have periods of seeing clearly what's going on, and then we have periods where our mind is just cluttered with a cloud of hindrances. Ahimsa's deep and steadfast really devotion to a flawed teacher left him vulnerable, right, to a twisted, sort of trance-like twisted logic that said in order to honor his teacher and what he had learned, he had to kill 1,000 people. So this delusion, this twisting, took his sensitivities from his gifts into his vulnerabilities. Our recurring hindrances may be related to our deepest sensitivities. And for those of you who know just a little bit of Pali, you know the Pali word for hindrance? Nivarana. So in Pali, which is the language of the previous suttas were recorded in, the word for hindrance is Nivarana. And Nivarana literally means a covering. You know, it's sometimes translated as a veil. You know, it covers something. So that's the bad news. It covers the truth. But the good news is it shows it right where it is. We just have to lift that veil, lift that covering. It just, the hindrance points out right to where our sensitivities are. So the question is, how do we lift that veil? How do we lift the covering? So in the story, it's really clear. The way you lift the covering is go have a chat with the Buddha. He'll straighten you out. Right? So you can just text him right now and answer an appointment. Unfortunately, I can't find his cell phone number. However, what we do have is the next best thing. He gave us a very precise practice for lifting the veil, for lifting that covering. And it's called the Four Ennobling Truths. Anybody ever heard of those? So let's look at them a little bit. So, Four Ennobling Truths, I just assume that many of you know these. So what's the first truth? Oh, come on.
Dukkha.
Yeah, it says that suffering, dissatisfaction, life rubs us, creates pain. Second truth?
Tanha
is a deep biological instinctive reflexive tightening that happens in us. Someone swerves in front of us while we're driving down the road and feels something. That's tanha. And tanha, if it's not relaxed, it gives rise to craving, which is how it's usually translated. But it's craving, also aversion and confusion. Liking, disliking, and confusion. I call them the Three Stooges. Lobha, dosa, and noma. Okay, so that's the second ennobling truth. The third?
Cessation of tanha.
Cessation of tanha. Okay. And nirodha is a Pali term, cessation. And the fourth ennobling truth?
The Noble Eightfold Path.
The Eightfold Path, right. So, okay. So, Four Ennobling Truths, and there is nothing noble about any of them. There is nothing profound about any of them. They are actually quite commonplace, ordinary and obvious. If you just take the first truth, is there anyone here who has never suffered? There is suffering. Duh. It's right there. There's nothing noble about root canals, broken fingers, broken relationships. If you take the second two truths and you put them together, you get this very simple statement that says, when we're uptight, it doesn't feel so good. When we're relaxed, it feels better. You doubt that? Try it. So the Buddha, what he actually did with these was he recommended four internal actions, four things to be done, different things for each one of these verbs. And when we engage these truths in this way, that's when they become ennobling. That's when they become uplifting, become free. It's not the truths themselves, and the truths aren't noble. It's we who are ennobled when we engage them in certain ways. One of my teachers, Bhante Vimal Ramsey, in applying the four ennobling truths to meditation, elaborated them slightly into six, which we affectionately call the six R's. Which are recognize, when the mind is distracted, recognize, release, relax or soften, smile or re-smile, return, and then repeat the whole process as needed. So what I'd like to do is to go through what the Buddha actually said about these four truths, and we'll just run it out a little bit about how this works when you apply these verbs to it. And just so you're rest assured that I'm not making this up, I will quote directly. This is from the Dhammacakkappa Pavattatthana. Dhammacakkappa Pavattatthana. Who said the Buddha wasn't a rapper? this is the discourse on setting the wheel of Dhamma in motion. This was the first sermon, the first discourse the Buddha ever gave. And for those who are interested in it, it's in the connected discourses, the Sangha Nikaya, number 5611. About the first truth, the Buddha said, the ennobling truth of suffering is to be fully understood. So the first action here that he's recommending, this is for lifting the veil, right? First action is to understand suffering. He didn't say to get one-pointed on it. He didn't say to rationalize it or to intellectualize it or to push it aside or lift it up or hold it down. He said to just understand it fully. It's a very simple thing. If you want to understand a friend, how do you do that? You have to open up to him. Intuitively, emotionally, intellectually, look beneath the surface. See what makes them tick, what inspires them, what wears them down. You know, to understand them fully. So the Buddha is suggesting that we need to do this with suffering, to understand fully how it operates. So this is the first R, you know, recognize. And we can't really understand something when we're trying to control it at the same time. And we really can't understand something when we're just enmeshed in the storyline. So the second R is to release it. So you're not trying to control it anymore. So this is the way the Buddha said suffering is to be understood. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. At least it does to one person. Thank you. So about the second truth, the Buddha said, the ennobling truth of the origin of suffering in Tanana is to be abandoned. Pretty dramatic word, abandon. So the ennobling way to engage Tanana is to abandon it. It's just to relax. That's how you abandon tension. Is to relax, mentally, emotionally, physically. And then the six R's, this is the third step, the relaxed step. You just relax. And you notice in this, we're not abandoning the suffering. We're not trying to walk away from it. We're not trying to turn lemons into lemonade, you know, or hold anything down. Let the suffering be what it is. But it's the tension that we abandon. It's the tension that we relax. Very important. To put it bluntly, understanding the source of suffering in Tanna is not going to do us much good. Abandoning or relaxing does. About the third truth, the Buddha said, the ennobling truth of the cessation of suffering is to be realized. Is to be realized. As the tension relaxes, there's a sense of relief. Right? Ah, feels good. And he said, what we're supposed to do with that relief is to realize how it came about. How it works. So if I'm suffering, as I was last year, because I needed a new computer. It was running slow and the keys were wearing out and, you know, it was doing all kinds of stuff. And then when I got a new computer, it felt great. You know, I was, you know, I got it. Now, why did it feel so good? Because I didn't want one anymore. Because I had one. Right? So wanting something is actually quite painful. Most people confuse getting what we want with not wanting anymore. So the Buddha said we have to realize how this operates. Because if we don't realize how it operates, then what we do, if we think we feel good because we got something, then the mind goes out and wants to get more things. And more, and more, and more, and more, and more. And we get caught in this cycle of wanting and having and wanting and having and wanting and not getting and wanting, you know. Lao Tzu wrote, we are rich when we know we have enough. So when the wanting, when that disappears, that's where the well-being comes from. So this third ennobling truth, you know, that is to be realized, how this cessation comes about, is related to the one, two, three, where the fourth R, which is re-smile. So when there's a relief, there's this sense of lightness that comes up. And if it doesn't come up automatically, you can smile a little bit, and that encourages and brings it up. And then in that lighter space, it's very easy. It's much easier to see what's really going on here. When we experience that cessation, that peacefulness, that little well-being, it's like, that's really great. And then it's gone. It doesn't last. Force of old habits kick in. Our fight or flight instincts get triggered. We just fall back into our old ways. But when you do that, there is this place inside that remembers what that felt like. And perhaps thinks, you know, is there some way I can cultivate more of that? Is there some way I can have more of that? And the Buddha said yes. His answer was the Eightfold Path. Okay. So this is what the Buddha said about the Eightfold Path. This ennobling truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering is to be developed. So it's something we develop and cultivate. It's not to be memorized or understood intellectually. It's not to be relaxed as we do with the Tanna. It's not even to be realized as with a sensation. But it's to be developed or cultivated. So we could go through the Eightfold Path, but that's a huge thing for, we'll leave that for another night. But I would like to go back now to our reflections on gifts and vulnerabilities and look just at the first aspects of the Eightfold Path, which is called Samadhi, wise view. Sometimes it's called right understanding, but I think a better translation is wise view. When Angulimala returned from his alms round bleeding and bruised, he didn't take the assaults personally. You know, he recognized, of course people are going to feel this way towards me. He'd known what he had done. And he just, so it was somewhat all impersonal. And that's really the essence of wise view. It's taking things impersonally. So when we meditate or go through our days, we too may feel assaulted by thoughts or distractions. Probably not as brutal as the kitchen utensils that Agulimala received. And so the question is, do these define us? Do we identify with these? Do we say, this is who I am? Or do we see them impersonally? Wise view is a way of seeing everything as impersonal. Wise view is not a philosophical stance. Wise view is not a deeply loved opinion that we carry. Wise view is not an educated stance or belief. Wise view is not a religious doctrine to be grafted onto our brain. It's just a way of seeing things impersonally. Or the way I would say it is taking dispassionate interest in whatever arises. So let me tell you another story to illustrate this. The story about another murderer. Me. So this was on the fifth day of a 10-day meditation retreat. I was back in the late 70s. I was meditating at Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And it had been a very peaceful morning for me, and I was deeply relaxed and sitting there meditating. The morning sunlight was coming in, and into this gentle space there arose just this faint image in my mind of a jagged dagger that I was pushing into my wife's back. Just this image came in. And I did not greet it with dispassionate interest or wise view. I freaked out. It's like, oh my God, is this some homicidal, urges hiding in my unconscious? What's, am I an Angulima pretending to be a Himsika? And so I just brought my attention back to the breath and I just held it there with white-knuckled intensity until the gong rang to end that sitting. And then at the beginning of the next sitting, when I sat down, I coached myself. I said, don't let an image of me stabbing Erica. Didn't work. And finally, I got it. There's no way to hide from the mind. Wherever I go, it seems to find me. It's just always there. So I thought, if I really have some hidden homicidal tendencies in here, maybe I better understand this. Maybe I better get to know these a little better. At least it jump out, at some time when, at a weak moment, And so despite my anxiety about it all, I decided there's really nothing left to do but turn towards it, to not fight it, just relax and open up and see if I could see what was going on underneath it. And you know what happened? When I stopped fighting the image, the whole thing just evaporated. A minute or two later, I couldn't even remember what all the turmoil was about. And so I brought the image back up and then relaxed into it and evaporated. And there was nothing to it. And then in that greater spaciousness, I could begin to see what had actually happened. That deep inside, I had this image that I held on to a little too tightly of me as being a good boy. I want to be a good boy. I want to do the right thing and stuff like that. And this image that could have been just a flicker off a TV screen, something, was so unacceptable to this little good boy image that I panicked, and then the fear just began to cycle on itself. But when I let go of the good boy, his evil twin evaporated at the same time. It was just gone. That was 40 years ago. And I think, what would it be like if I had spent the last four decades doing everything I could to keep that image down, to keep it away from me? It would have built up such an incredible charge inside. So this is an example of wise view. And I think, you know, for me, wisdom comes really when I don't see any other options. You know, I'd like to think I would just do it because I'm smart, but it's really more when I just don't see any other options. I didn't see it any other choice, but just sort of relax and look and get to know what's going on. So rather than try to control thoughts or images, when we look at our practice with wise view, we just open up, you know, see what's there, recognize it, and relax. And as we do this, we begin to see that our suffering has, right in the middle of it, there's always some tension. So we let that soften. So relax it. And then realize how it happened. So you see how the whole process works. Okay. So, about to run out of time here. It's all too easy. It's all too easy to think of Ahimsaka and Agulima as two separate entities that serially inhabit one being. But the Buddha didn't see it that way. Ahimsaka and Agulima were in fact the same being. The same sensitivities were there. It was just different conditions bring forth different kinds of responses. But they weren't different people. Our gifts and our vulnerabilities do not arise out of separate angels and demons within us. They arise out of the unified truth, even if our delusions say otherwise. So if you feel assaulted by hindrances and you want to get away from them, the fastest way to do that is see them all as nivarana, is see them all as coverings, is see them all as masks. Hindrances are just masks, disguising a deeper truth. Don't get caught in the storylines. Just release and relax and see what's there. And when you look inside, all you see is a gulimala, then you're not seeing deeply enough. You've been relaxing and going deeper. Buddha never said that we have an Anakin Skywalker and a Darth Vader inside. But he did counsel over and over again, cultivating wise view, where we look at all these things, like what Rich was saying about metta, looking at all things with the same sort of relaxed, open acceptance. We humans are very sensitive creatures. We are creatures who stood up on our hind legs and exposed the softness of our bellies to the world. If we treat our sensitivities with fear, with denial, with rejection, that doesn't change the present moment one bit. Right? But what it does is that it conditions the future moments to have more fear and rejection, in which case our sensitivities become a curse. However, if we treat our present experience, whatever it is, with kindness, then our sensitivities become a blessing. They become a blessing. And with that, our natural luminosity that's underneath all of that just comes to the surface. And the teachings of Don Juan, Carlos Castaneda wrote, "Does this path have a heart? If it does, the path is good. If it doesn't, it's of no use. Both paths lead nowhere. We all die. Both paths lead nowhere. But one has heart, the other doesn't. One makes for a joyful journey. As long as you follow it, you are one with it. The other will make you curse your life. One makes you strong. The other weakens you." Namaste. We have just a couple of minutes if there's a few questions or comments.
I like the double meaning of realize on the third truth. So it's one way is what you were talking about, and then the other way I like to think of it is to make it real.
Yeah.
Make cessation real is the task.
Yeah.
And like you were talking about, to actually notice those tiny little moments that go zipping by, but then to make those real, notice them.
Yeah. And I don't know about you. You know, some of you know I was depressed for the first 4 years of my life, and I began to notice that at one point that there's this kind of luminosity that's, you know, it sort of seems like it's in the back of my mind that I always ignore because it's so far from what I identified with. I said, why do I keep ignoring that? Maybe I'll just sort of pay attention to that. Just get stronger and stronger.
I really connected with you when you were talking about suffering and then relaxing and why we tense up and how to appreciate that I can relax in the moment of anxiety and overwhelmment. I could just feel relaxed and I don't have to suffer. That's a choice.
Life brings discomfort, but whether we suffer is whether it has, depends on resisting it. You know, so, you know, get a cut on your arm may bring strong sensation, and if you fight it, if you try to wall it off, not be there, then you actually suffer in a sense of anguish. But if you just open up to it, it doesn't change. So there is still a sharp sensation, but we actually don't suffer. In the sense that we're not fighting it so much. Does that distinction make sense? I mean, people say that very glibly, you know, that pain is given, suffering is optional. But that sort of makes it seem like it's a thought crime. Because the body naturally tightens. You know, it's a deeply instinctual response. So the training is actually to recognize it when it's softened. Because the softening is actually very simple. And it's a thing that makes the Buddha's path different than any other meditations that were available at his time, was that actually that relaxed step. And it's just, it's as simple as that. As simple as that. Thank you, Ginger. So, the last relief is that it's time to go home. So let's take just a moment. Our hearts have an incredible capacity to sense not only the depths of our life, but to sense the life around us, far out into the world. And so do the other hearts out there. So knowing that sensitivity that we all have, just taking a moment here, dedicating our gifts, our sensitivities, not only to our own healing and uplift, but to the healing of all beings everywhere. May all beings be free. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings have ease and well-being as they go through their days.